Chapter 12.
When I first came to Chicago, I thought of a harbor as a giant bowl of ocean, with ships and boats in the foreground and the faded outline of the buildings on the far side in the background. I had always imagined political subversives dressed up as tribal natives and a huge hit in the profit margin of the East India Company. Burnham Harbor looked like the parking lot of an ocean-going Walmart. It might have been able to hold a football field or three. White wharves stretched out over the water with pleasure boats and small fishing vessels in rows within the placid oval of water. The scent of the lake was one part dead fish, one part algae-coated rock, and one part motor oil. I parked in a lot up the hill from the harbor, got out, and made sure I had my equipment with me. I wore my force ring on my right hand and my shield bracelet on my left wrist, and my blasting rod thumped against my leg where I had tied it to the inside of my leather duster. I'd added a can of self-defense spray to my arsenal, and I slipped it into my pants pocket. I would rather have had my gun, but toting it around in my pocket was a felony. The pepper spray wasn't. I locked up the car and felt a sudden slithering pressure on my back, my instinct's way of screaming that someone was watching me. I kept my head down, my hands in my pockets, and walked toward the harbor. I didn't rubberneck around, but I tried to get a look at everything while moving only my eyes. I didn't see anyone, but I couldn't shake the impression that I was being observed. I doubted it was anyone from the Red Court. The morning hadn't reached full brightness yet, but it was still light enough to parboil a vampire. That didn't rule out any number of other flavors of assassin, though, and it was possible that if the thieves were here, they were keeping an eye on everyone coming and going. All I could do was walk steadily and hope that whoever was watching me wasn't one of Marcone's thugs, a vampire groupie or a rent-a-gun aiming a rifle at my back from several hundred yards away. I found the étranger in a few minutes, moored at a slip not far from the entrance. It was a pretty little ship, a white pleasure boat roomy enough to house a comfortable cabin. The étranger wasn't new, but she looked neat and well cared for. A Canadian flag hung from a little stand on the ship's afterdeck. I moved on past the ship at a steady pace and listened as I did. Listening is a trick I'd picked up when I was a kid. Not many people have worked out the trick of it, blocking out all other sound in order to better hear one sound in particular, such as distant voices. It isn't as much about magic, I think, as it is focus and discipline. But the magic helps.
"Unacceptable," said a quiet female voice in the étranger's cabin. It was marked with a gentle accent, both Spanish and British. "The job entailed a great deal more expense than was originally estimated. I'm raising the price to reflect this, nothing more."
There was a short pause, and then the woman said,
"Would you like an invoice for your tax return, then?"
"I told you the quote was only an estimate. It happens."
Another pause, and then the woman said,
"Excellent. As scheduled, then."
I stared out at the lake, just taking in the view, and strained to hear anything else. Evidently, the conversation was over. I checked around, but there weren't any people in sight moving around the harbor on a February weekday morning. I took a breath to steady myself and moved closer to the ship. I caught a glimpse of motion through a window in the cabin and heard a chirping sound. A cell phone rested on a counter beside a pad of hotel stationery. A woman appeared in the window dressed in a long gown of dark silk and picked up the cell phone. She answered it without speaking and a moment later said,
"I'm sorry, you've the wrong number."
I watched as she put the phone down and casually let the nightgown slide to the floor. I watched a little more. I wasn't being a peeping Tom. This was professional. I noted that she had some intriguing curves. See? Professionalism in action. She opened a door, and a bit of steam wafted out, the sound of the water growing louder. She stepped in and closed the door again, leaving the cabin empty. I had an opportunity. I'd seen only one woman, and not well enough to positively identify her as either Anna Valmont or Francisca Garcia, the two remaining church mice. I hadn't seen the shroud hanging from a laundry line or anything. Even so, I had the feeling I'd come to the right place. My gut told me to trust my spiritual informer. I made my decision and stepped up a short gangplank onto the Etranger. I had to move fast. The woman on the ship might not be a fan of long showers. All I needed to do was get inside, see if I could find anything that might verify the presence of the shroud, and get out again. If I moved quickly enough, I could get in and out without anyone the wiser.